Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
Welcome to a classic big interview. This season, we're going all the way back to 2019-2020, and we've picked out one of our absolute favourites. This is what I had to say about it back then. Let me explain to you how I began this chat with the world's greatest defender. As a smiling and pretty relaxed Virgil van Dijk came out onto the balcony of what, during the interview, I'm going to describe as one of the great landmarks of the world, this beautiful five-star hotel overlooking Lake Geneva and Lausanne. As Virgil came out, we haven't met before, I don't think he knew much about the big interview, and I said to him, we haven't asked to come and share this time with you to interview you because you're famous or because you're a Champions League winner. At this series, the big interview, our socios, Martin, Neil and I are obsessed with football, footballers and football stories. And that's all we want. There'll be no bullshit, there'll be nothing that would make headlines. We want you to explain defending, explain your life and explain your career to us. To sit with Virgil van Dijk and talk about his tuition under Ronald Koeman, what he learned at Celtic, the emotion of the fan reception from Anfield, one-on-one defending, reading the game, accepting risk when he intercepts the ball, how to use the ball. These things came up, so did Messi, Barcelona, just about everything you need, in fact. You're about to listen to the big interview with Graham Hunter, joined, thankfully, by Dutch legend, world number one defender, Ballon d'Or candidate, Mr. Virgil van Dijk. Big interview listeners, welcome to a terrace, a beautiful sort of terracotta terrace overlooking Lake Geneva. One of the most beautiful spots that this interview has ever been recorded in. And we're here by the personal invitation of Mr. Virgil van Dijk. Virgil, you're a man of class. Thank you for having us in general and talking to us about football, but particularly thank you for having us here. This is not the worst place to work, is it?
No, it's absolutely amazing. I think if you... Everyone can look at this view, obviously, they will love it, and it's very special to have this interview, obviously, with this view.
There are little white boats dotting around in a sea of blue. There's manicured trees, a golf course, but this is the way that we think elite footballers, elite athletes should be treated, because you entertain us, you gift us a lot of fun, and everybody who's listened to our series before knows that the first thing I'm going to ask you about is the art of defending. We don't run this series because the people we speak to are famous, or even, although many of them have been funny, because they're funny, it's because of our sort of obsession with football. So if you'd accept my view that right now you've put yourself, as well as, you know, lifting the Champions League and running a season in England which was record-breaking, you've put yourself, in my view, in a two-man contention for the Ballon d'Or, my view. You've done that because you're extremely good at your art. Start me by explaining a little bit about, given that you've played in the past up front, do you enjoy defending in itself? Not only winning, lifting trophies, earning lots of money, do you enjoy the process, the psychology of defending?
I do a lot, to be fair. Obviously, scoring goals is always great. It's always a nice feeling, especially to celebrate it with your teammates, the fans and everything, and think about a nice celebration and stuff. But if you can stop the opposition from scoring, I think that gives me a great buzz. I think obviously last season we had many clean sheets, and I think at times we were just like, we were 3-4-0 up and we thought like, we have to keep a clean sheet no matter what, and keeps you going, keeps you, you know, like very motivated and hard on each other as well. When there is one slight, you know, hiccup or, you know, slight mistake, we just get at each other. And I think it just give me, and I think the rest of our defenders, you know, a great boss.
You see, as you're doing the pitch, you've intercepted me, because I know we means the team, but I knew you were talking about the unit,
yeah,
the boys, the four in front of the keeper and the keeper, right? You work as a little mean machine.
Well, I think if you look at all of us, Liverpool as a team, how we defend is from the front. And if you really analyse our, you know, defensive tactics, and you see that those three up front, they run so much and they press like crazy. And if a team manages to beat that press, then they come from behind and you have our midfield. And if by any chance they come, you know, past our midfield, then obviously we have our defensive line and an amazing goalkeeper as well. So, you know, it's the defending we do is all credit to the whole team and the way we defend.
I mean, I understand that. And if you look at, presumably, normally you're talking about Sané and Bobby and Mo.
Sadio, yes.
In how they press and how they harass and how they click with the midfielder behind them and how hard they make it for the opposition guys to think or react, yeah, or maybe a tiny miscontrol. What they're doing allows you a lot more reading time, am I right?
It does, and it does, I think it does especially make the opposition think 10 times quicker than they normally have to do. So when they get the ball, they don't have the time to actually like turn up, turn open and have a look around where they're going to pass the ball. There's always going to be one or two guys, you know, coming at them, and they have to play the ball quick, and then the next guy have to do the same. So in the end, if they play the ball forward, it's probably a difficult ball for the strikers or the midfielders as well, and makes it easier obviously for us.
Because one of the things, there are several things I'd like you to explain to us, but one of the things that really attracts me to your play is I've always liked the concept of risk, calculated risk. Not buccaneer, cavalier, no. I'll just do it, but calculated risk. And so often, when you watch a showreel, particularly as you've developed, I'm not saying it was always so, but particularly at Liverpool, you see things several beats before opposition players, other defenders. You come in, you read, you intercept, but you don't intercept solely because of size or pace. You've read it more quickly. And so often, two things occur to me. And also tell me if I'm talking bullshit. Mm-hmm. You're allowed to go, nah, that's rubbish, mm-hmm, mate.
Yeah, yeah,
but when you come in and you've anticipated and you break through and you win the ball, one, there's often a gap between you and the player you've robbed. It's not like me and you and I've just won, mm-hmm, it. And secondly, more often than not, you're doing something correct with it. It'll be a nudge to a player, a header to a player. It's not like, right, that's clear, that I've extinguished that danger, or I've extinguished the danger and put it into the stand. The next thing is the ball goes the right place.
Yeah.
Is that true?
No, that's most of the time I try to do that. I don't think a tackle is necessary, or getting in challenges sometimes is necessary. I think if you manage to, you know, get in the right position, I think, you know, you can win the ball a lot and, you know, play on when you win the ball. And I think also, you know, obviously sometimes you have to get in challenges and you have to get tight and you have to make a slide tackle or anything like that. But what I said before, if the opposition are under pressure, normally they find no solution and try to, you know, find for the easy ball. And the easy ball is normally in the channel and let the striker run for it and let him, you know, hope to hold the ball. And so I'm most of the time looking at the guy on the ball, mm-hmm, see what he, you know, try to read what he thinks, what he's going to do, what his next move is. And I think that's something I've developed, you know, and be aware, obviously, of what's around you. But you know, if the guy on the ball doesn't have any eye for the, you know, for the striker or for anyone close to you, or you feel like he's not in a position to play any ball, then there's no harm or there's no danger.
The satisfaction of doing your job well, helping the team, roar from the fans when you win something, win the ball, great. But is, in psychological terms, is there a personal satisfaction when you're like, I see this situation, I'm going to read it, I'm going to do this, and it comes off? Psychologically, that's a huge, that must give you a massive adrenaline buzz.
Yeah, definitely. You know, I think the most important thing after a game is the clean sheet as a defender. And then we have a very big chance that we won the game. Mm-hmm. But if you have moments in games where you, but when it looks that you actually didn't do anything, that means you did a very good, you know, very good job. And I think that's a very, you know, very good feeling, I think, to have.
When I watch you, I never quite, with certain centre-halves, certain defenders, you can tell when they like to have a real ding-dong battle with the strikers. Mm-hmm. And I'm not quite sure with you. I sometimes feel you're like, as long as you're beating them, as long as you're keeping the clean sheet and doing the job, they're an irrelevance to you. I don't know. But in this series, we've had a lot of interviews, and although his quote is famous, Troy Deeney was one of our interviews. And we simply, as we will with you, we just said to him, talk about these five defenders, not just you. And he immediately went, I mean, so you've heard it, but like, I hate going up against them. Too big, too strong, too quick, too good in the ball. Loves fighting, good head of hair, and smells lovely too. Okay, fine. But not Troy himself, but when a striker, if a striker feels these things about you, are you pleased, or is it a complete irrelevance? Because there are defenders who like to go like, I've done you today, and then in 6 months when I see you again, I'm going to do you again, and you get in their head.
There's not like something in me that I want to get in striker's head at all. I just like to win my battle against any striker, and that's what happened. Obviously, the same with him. And he's a very English, you know, type of striker. He's very strong, vocal with his team. He fights for every yard on the pitch, and you know that's difficult to play against sometimes. But you have to adapt, and I think I'm at that stage right now that I know how to adapt on certain strikers who I'm going to face. We have a lot of fantastic strikers in England, so every week is a big challenge. And if it's now against Trodini, or if it's like against Sergio Aguero, you know, you have to adapt on it, and then you have to play your own game as well. And, I'm not like that type of guy that, you know, talks to other strikers like, you know, like, oh, in the game or anything, but I think you frustrate them more if you just, you know, win your battle and don't give them any sniff, basically.
The details you've got about adapting for other strikers, is it all in your mind? Do you rely on the video cuts? Is it helpful to study sometimes, or do you never need to do that?
Well, I think if I'm playing against them once, I know who I'm going to face. And so right now, obviously, the strikers that I've played last year, I know almost every one of them, because I've played against them at least one time, I think, before. So, you know, this season will be the same, and obviously every strike improve, and we'll definitely want to, you know, do very well against me and like to the other centre-backs in the Premier League. But I want to do better as well. Keep improving, keep, you know, working hard. I think the most important thing is to stay humble as well, you know. Work hard, know that you have to improve, you can improve. And that's why I'm definitely am as well.
One of the things that, again, stands out, if you take a snapshot image of Virgil van Dijk enjoying his football and helping the team, goes beyond defending. It's you use the ball regularly, really well, often right, but equally so, or to some degree, left to Andy. And you ping balls rather like I saw Gerard Piqué doing in the 2010 World Cup, when people underestimated how important it was for him to turn, switch the play, pull teams out of position, nice long diagonal ball, which you regularly do to your fullbacks. First of all, has the manager set the team up positionally? Do you now, they call it in Spain, automatismo, automatic things? I don't know what your Dutch upbringing was, but are you almost subliminally aware, you know where they're going to be, and it's just a natural reflex? Or
I think when we play out, for example, there's always multiple options you have. Everyone knows basically what kind of position we have to be in, and that's what we work for every training almost.
So repetitive that it becomes automatic.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah, we have different options, and you always have to create options for the guy on the ball. And that's the same when I get the ball. I want to have options there, you know, left, right, and center, and behind as well. And you have to give each other the options. Otherwise, you can't play basically. So that's what I know. When I have the ball, I try to find the right option, because not always the option that's available is the right one. But you know, you try to find the right one, and that's what you have to do to make it a little bit easier for you, for everyone.
But that diagonal pass, you seem to enjoy it.
Yeah, you know, it's a quality of me, of myself. I like to give it, and I like to switch it up as well. So our fullbacks, our wingers, they like sometimes when we're on one side to switch to the other side, because there's more space as well. So that's always going to be there, but that's not the option, the first option I'm thinking of.
Footballers sometimes don't see all this, but this is in Madrid. This is the Virgil van Dijk song. And they're singing about the things that you talked about. One of the lines is about you passing the ball. I mean, you were preparing for the final, so you didn't see this. You might have seen this video.
I've seen it on the day itself, before the game.
That kind of devotion is special, right?
It is. And my family was in that plaza as well, in the middle.
Jumping and dancing and singing?
Yeah.
Are they allowed to sing along about you, yeah?
Yeah, they're allowed to do anything they want, especially that day.
The reason I'm showing it, I mean, it was part of winning that title. It's so astonishing the way that the fans reacted, behaved, interacted, also the Spurs fans. But, like, when you make these passes, look at the words, you know? Watch him defend, watch him score, he can pass the ball, calm as you like. Is Anfield one of those places where you're not making the passes to please the fans? I know that. But when you make these passes, Anfield is an audience that likes watching that kind of elegant football from the back, right or wrong?
It is, definitely. I think Anfield is also a place for everyone that gives out 100% every day and every game and don't leave any regrets on the pitch. And that's the feeling I got from Anfield since day one. I think if you give everything you have, blood, sweat and tears basically, and you come off the pitch and everything is, you know, you give everything, I think everyone will definitely be there for you and cheer you on. And obviously it's all about results in the end of the day, but if you give everything, then you know, you have no regrets. And I think that should be the base to do, because you know, you don't only play for yourself, you play for all those fans around the world, all everyone that's come watch you play, your family, and obviously for the badge, you know, as well. And so that's what I've definitely, you know, felt like from day one of signing.
In the months before you signed, I was out working, interviewing Xavi in Qatar, and it was a football event, and there was a guy there who said, his name escapes me, but he said, I used to play kids football with Virgil. He said, believe me, he's going to Liverpool, believe me. I've often wondered, well, you made the decision for lots of reasons. Was Liverpool a special club for you when you were young? Or were you not so aware of them?
Liverpool, well, I was definitely aware of them. But I had dreams to go to the Premier League, and that was the big dream. And I didn't really, like, at that time, I didn't really...
Right from a kid?
Well, since I was playing at the academy of Willem II. Fulham. So it was always a dream to go to the Premier League. And when I went to Celtic, and then obviously that dream came closer, then I started to think about, you know, different clubs, and Liverpool was definitely one of them.
A lot can happen in the next 3 years. Like, a chatbot may be your new best friend. But what won't change? Needing health insurance. UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans are available for these changing times. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer budget-friendly, flexible coverage
for people who are in between jobs or missed open enrollment. The plans last nearly 3 years in some states, with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. So for whatever tomorrow brings, UnitedHealthcare Tri-Term Medical Plans may be for you. Learn more at uh1.com.
This is Paige, the co-host of Giggly Squad, and I want to tell you about a company that I've been loving, Olive & June. Olive & June gives you everything that you need for a salon-quality manicure in one box. And if you break it down, it really comes out to $2 a manicure, which is absolutely insane. It's also so easy to get salon-worthy nails at home with Olive & June. The difference between how your nails used to look when you did them yourself and now with the Manny system is a complete game changer. The best thing about Olive & June, too, is it's a quick dry. It dries in about 1 minute, lasts for 5 days, and full coverage in up to 1 to 2 coats. Visit oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system. That's oliveandjune.com/perfectmanny20 for 20% off your first system.
I know that also the guy who was part of signing at Celtic, John Park was his name. He said he did the deal in Schiphol with your old agent and the club all at one time. And I asked him about what he saw in you originally, and he said, it's this thing about, I talked about calculated risk. He said that when he was watching, he said, yeah, okay, sometimes we saw chances that went wrong, some errors. He said, but I loved his football arrogance, not personal arrogance, football arrogance. I'll do the right thing. If it doesn't happen, I'll do the right thing again, and then I'll do it again. It was, is that what you were doing naturally or trying to do at Groningen when they spotted you? In other words, if I'm doing the right thing that doesn't come off, that's a risk that I'll accept.
Yeah, like there was times, I think, at Groningen and even at Celtic at times that I did just enough, you know what I mean? So when there was a 1v1 sprint and I know I was going to beat him, I just did just enough, you know, sprint that I could, you know, that I could get him and obviously, you know, play the ball back or anything. And I've learned over the years that you just have to, you know, give everything. Makes it look maybe a little bit more easier, but you know, you make it easier also for your teammates, and that's something I definitely developed. And it makes it also makes me also more concentrated in games. Makes me also more aware, and I think less mistakes as well.
So, do you think that the moves to Celtic, to Southampton, to Liverpool, that pressure on you, demands on you, expectations on you, have accelerated that personal development or that learning process?
I think the step to Celtic from Holland was such a good one, such a big one for me. Living abroad, talking English, Scottish every day.
Can you talk Scottish?
I understand obviously every bit of it, of course, now. But yeah, it was such a fantastic experience.
Did you find it testing?
It was in the beginning, yeah.
Why?
Well, I remember the first week I arrived there, looking for houses was already a thing, training with the group. Then I made my debut against, I think it was Aberdeen away. And then, as your team, Aberdeen away, and we won, I think.
So that yeah, probably,
good.
Yeah.
That was good. And then the day, a couple of days after, we went to Kazakhstan. And Neil Lennon thought he's going to put me in. So I started that game on artificial grass and we lost 2-0, I think. And that was very testing because we stayed overnight as well, and I got so many bad reactions from so many, you know, fans, and they were right. I was poor that night, and then it's how are you going to bounce back from that? And I remember the return game at Celtic Park, because it was the final basically until you're going to be in the Champions League.
Yeah.
I was on the bench.
Mm.
And we came 1-0 up, 2-0 up, and we scored a 3-0. So basically we were through, and then the last couple of minutes I came on and we all celebrated because I was going to play Champions League and we were going to play Champions League. And that's why that was one of the big reasons I went to Celtic as well, to experience Champions League with Celtic. And it was a very challenging couple of weeks at that time. And after, let's say, three or four games, I had the flow and I kept playing and kept progressing, and I felt so good. And obviously, like, the quality of my game kept getting better as well. And yeah, and after that, the year after, you know, becoming champions, you know, was a big thing for me. And you know, you take it all in, and obviously the step to Southampton afterwards, working with Ronald Koeman.
Oh, I do want to ask you about that, because, and obviously you've passed over Glasgow, where one of our guests was Stoyan Petrov. Okay, the change from Bulgarian to English is different from the change from learning English in Holland to coming, but you didn't have to work in a burger van like Stan did.
No,
knew about that story. He told us that story that he went to work in a burger van
really?
To learn how, literally. He had a pal who was a supporter, and Celtic midfielder Stan Petrov would go and serve burgers at night in order to be able to speak quickly in Scottish, which is an extreme method.
It is very extreme.
But you have to respect his professionalism. I hope this doesn't sound self-indulgent, but it's just true. I was at camp now. It was the game where Celtic came over and you would lose 6-1. I'm friendly with Gary McAllister, and Gary McAllister was phoned me, was working at Liverpool at the time, and he said, listen, I'd value your opinion. We're weighing up Andy Robertson, Kieran Kearney. We see great potential in both of them. We're not quite sure. Just, you know, have a look at how Kieran copes in the camp now. Mm-hmm. So it was a difficult night, and he didn't have a lot he could do. Mm-hmm. But I remember phoning John Park at Celtic that night or the next morning and saying, never mind the result, Virgil van Dijk could play for Barcelona now, this week. That was my point of view. Irrespective of, and that's one of the things, I'm a great devotee of listening to Cruyff, was interviewed him, I know Jordi, and you don't look at the scoreline.
Yeah.
If you're looking at ideas, behaviour, risk acceptance, doing the right things, irrespective of what's happening around you, didn't you feel at that stage, not that night, but when you're playing well for Celtic and you're starting to lift trophies and you learn the winning habit, didn't you feel that you were already Premier League material, top Premier League material as a defender? Or did you need what Koeman and Southampton taught you? I'd like to know.
I think in the end, how everything went has been perfect for me. I think I felt after my second season that I was ready for the step up, and that's what I've said to the club, and in the end, obviously, it all happened. But it wasn't that I thought, like, I'm ready for the top in the Premier League or
something.
No. It was just like, I'm ready to play in the Premier League, show myself, mm-hmm. and make my dream come true, because it was a massive dream for me to play in the Premier League. Sorry.
Yeah.
When it actually happened, obviously, with Koeman was, you know, a double plus for me, because, you know, I wanted to work with Ronald Koeman also for as long as I, you know, I've played for Groningen with, and his father was, he was working there, and I have many conversations with him, and yeah, and obviously Koeman is a big name as well.
He's a teacher, I think, and I watched particularly where I have liked best his football is when he was teaching that young Ajax side that went to Milan, nearly knocked them out. Pinar was in the centre midfield. I believe he's a professor, he's a teacher, he's somebody who's very good at telling you how positionally you should work, systems should work, passes should work. Tell me about him teaching you.
When, for example, this is just an example, for example, we had a passing exercise, let's say with, you know, you had 10 on one side, 10 on the other side, and he would have watched me and maybe another two. He would watch everyone, basically, but when we're giving 10 passes, everyone's giving 10 passes, and I'm giving 9 good, 1 bad, and the rest give 5 good, 5 bad. He would shout at me, and you know, everyone could hear it as well. And that was just, you know, something he is, and he wanted to work with me so, you know, so bad as well. He wanted to improve me, and wanted to make me a better player. And I was so happy in the end that he did those kind of things with me. In the beginning, you're like,
leave me alone.
Yeah, like the other guys, you know, 5 passes bad as well, and you're coming from me when I give 1, you know, bad pass. And in the end, I got to appreciate those kind of things, and I just respect him so much as a manager, of course, but as a human being as well. And I've had many conversations with him. You know, still, obviously now I'm the captain of Holland, and it just I've such a great relationship with him, and he's still like a coach, like a manager. That, you know, when we, for example, are having boxes here, and there's another box over there, and he's standing there, and he walks up to our box to have a look at us, then I'm really, like, you know,
do everything perfect.
Exactly. That's what he tried to do, and that's something he brought on. You know, he just gave it to me.
Because you couldn't have seen so much of him.
No, as a player, no. Obviously, I've seen footage online, but obviously, as a young guy, I don't see too much of him. No.
His legend was there because of 88 and 92 at Wembley with Barcelona, etc. Of course, he won the European Cup with PSV as well under maybe Ericsson. But at least, what have you got that you and he share in terms of football ideas or football abilities? Never mind the position. Are there similarities in how you can bring the ball out? How you can?
I think he was at that time. Obviously, he played more as a sweeper. I think.
Yeah.
So he just, he scored a lot of goals. He came in the box as well.
His goal tally is extraordinary.
A lot of power in his shots as well.
But you
too. Maybe that's something both the same. But also as a leader, and I think he's also a fantastic man manager. Player management. What we've obviously experienced right now at the national team, he is very good with talking to us, talking to the players, communicating personally with me when there are issues or anything. And obviously, I'm the captain, but you still have to do it. And it's just something that I'm really enjoying.
You, if I'm not wrong, was it the Nations League game where part of England's defeat seemed to come from a player playing from the back in John Stones? You seem to that day look for that player, look to target him, knowing as coach, I suppose, how difficult it is to bring it out. You know it too. I'm not looking for any controversy, but in, say, our country, in England, there seems to be an appetite to say, don't play it from the back, don't do it ever. And one mistake, one problem, and let's abandon this. Never mind your level of success, but as a Dutchman, as somebody who's grown up in a country where that is believed in, do you find it odd or eccentric that so many people, even in the industry, not just journalists or fans, go like, don't do this?
Yeah. Well, when things are not going well, everyone wants to change things, you know what I mean? But sometimes you have to trust the process. We're trying to play out from the back. A lot of times Man City does it. At the national team we try to do it, obviously. There's a risk of that doesn't go well. And that night we practiced a lot on pressing the opponent from goal kicks, especially because we knew that England obviously wanted to play out. We've seen it obviously on the footage, and we know also that they have players that we can press. And at what I said before, we trained it the days before, and for us, obviously, was very good that it worked out in the end.
We have socios. Liam McLaughlin is one of them. This probably is a quick question that asks for a little bit more detail. He says, "Hi, Graham. Hi, Virgil. As a Celtic fan, could you ask Virgil what he values the most from his who or what he values the most his time at Celtic in terms of your development? What would it be, a person, would it be a thing at Celtic that you value the most?"
I think it would just be the whole transfer to Celtic. I think the city, Gromy, the players, that Neil Lennon was there obviously to also learn me more about the English culture, Scottish culture at that time, obviously, like the British mentality, but also the way of playing. I remember in one of the first games, and maybe I don't know the team again, maybe Ross County or something, and we put him under pressure at Celtic Park, and it was one of my first games there, I think, and I remember that I wanted to push up, and then I forgot that when they have no option, they just ball in the channel, and I was like, and then he kept running, and I was like, you have to really adapt on that and be ready for those balls. And that's something I've learned, but I think everything has just been so good for me. And the fans obviously have been special to me. Those European nights, you can't describe it. And obviously to experience those nights at Liverpool, because they're quite similar. That's just something you want to play for. And
it's nice to be loved, isn't it?
It is fantastic to be loved, yeah.
Who's the toughest opponent you've ever come up against, full stop?
I would say Lionel Messi. He is, if not maybe the best player in the history of football, I think. But what I've seen him play live, for the other guys, I can't really, you know, say too much. But he's doing it so consistently as well, and you have to respect that. And it is such a difficult striker because he's so small, and he is maybe 60% of the whole game. He's walking around and wait for the right, obviously when they win the ball, and then he's off. And yeah, he's a fantastic striker.
Talking about respect, we said we respect our timescale. We're kind of running out for the pre-allocated timescale. You've just thrown in Leo Messi, mm-hmm. So maybe you'll permit me to have a long section to close. You talked about the enjoyment of my two part to this question before we finalise. That night I Matt knows I recorded a video from Camp Nou. I live in Barcelona.
Yep.
I spent years watching him. So can anybody send me an answer to what just happened? Because I'd seen what I thought was tiny errors aside, brilliance from Liverpool. I thought that the performance probably was a 5-2 win for Liverpool. Something of that order. And he'd lost 3-0.
Yeah.
How the hell did you process that experience? Because it wasn't in any way sane. It wasn't justice.
No.
I've never in my life seen anything like that.
Yeah. I said exactly the same after the game. I went to the mix zone and everyone obviously was asking me questions like, what now? And I said to everyone, like, I felt strange. We lost 3-0, but obviously the first goal was I could have done better there, but the second goal, the third goal, yeah, it happened. And the way we played, the way we pressed them, the way we put them in so much problems, and I think at one point, 20 minutes into the game, I look behind me, I see Suarez and Messi just on hands on their knees and tired.
They were out of breath.
Yeah, because we put them under so much pressure, and I don't think there was, you know, too many teams that did that, especially over there. And yeah, it felt strange, and we were all pretty calm. Obviously, we were very disappointed that we lost 3-0, because you have to be realistic if you want to come back for a 3-0 defeat against, you know, team that has one of the best players, if not the best player in the world, then you need a miracle. And when we came back, we played Newcastle, I think, in the weekend. That was a very tough game.
3-2
in the last 10 minutes of the game. And after that, full focus was on Barcelona. And I think Bobby was out. Mo was out. Bobby and Mo were out. And yeah, obviously, You want to give everything on the pitch. You want to, what I said already, you want to have no regrets on the pitch. You're going to go for it. And to score the 1-0 after, I don't know, 34 minutes. I can't remember exactly. And to go 1-0 at halftime. And everyone at halftime said, you know, boys, we can do this.
It's there.
We can do this. And obviously in the end, then, when Gini scored those two goals and Leaf with the famous corner, then, you know, it's just crazy.
1956, the whole Ballon d'Or thing is launched. I'm not asking you to advertise. I would vote for you, and I think Messi's the greatest footballer ever. How can it be that only two defenders in the entire history of that award, Beckenbauer and Cannavaro, have won it? What has happened to our appreciation of the art of what you do? Do you have any explanation for that?
I have no explanation for that, no. I can only, you know, talk for right now, and that people are putting me in the bracket to win.
Yeah,
the Ballon d'Or is obviously a massive honor. And
would you vote for you?
Well, you have to back yourself, isn't it?
That's thank you. I'm going to phone Messi and I'm going to ask him. And when I get the message, I'm going to send it back to you because I think he'll probably see you.
Yeah, but you know, if you don't back yourself, no one will. So yeah, we'll see. If the people already talking about it, is such a great honor, and the only thing I can do is to work hard, stay humble, and keep improving.
You've convinced me. You've got my vote. Wow. The Scottish jury. Listen, man, thank you. It's been a joy.
Hold up.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.